rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Rodenberg, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning. I'd say welcome to the Court of Appeals, but I guess you're actually not here. You're only virtually here, but thank you for participating in our oral calendar today and our interactive television. The case that we have scheduled now for hearing is Towley v. Wick. And if we could hear from both counsel, then we can verify that you're actually connected to us. Because we only get the video if there is audio coming from your microphone. So, counsel for appellant.
Jeremy Klinger on behalf of appellants David and Kathleen Towley.
All right. And on behalf of the respondents.
Brian Nixon on behalf of the respondents.
Okay. And we also have our second case on for oral calendar. I don't think the parties are all gathered together, so both of you are arguing from the same spot for our first case, so that will be helpful to us. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel. If you would like to use that time for rebuttal, please keep your argument limited to those timing restrictions, and please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track on our audio recording of the proceedings, attaching the lawyers to the right arguments. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Jeremy Klinger. I represent the appellants David and Kathleen Towley. I may please the court, counsel. This case was tried before the court. Originally, the judge ruled in favor of the Towleys on the issue of the boundary line by practical location, but had ruled against them on the case as a whole due to the unclean hands issue. The Towleys then brought a motion to amend the findings and or a new trial. Then the judge denied that motion with respect to the new trial and amended findings on unclean hands, the unclean hands issue, but then reversed itself on the issue for finding in their favor with respect to the boundary line by practical location. So this appeal then followed. I want to touch on the issue with respect to the unclean hands equitable defense first, Your Honors, because I think that's essentially the bigger issue here with respect to appeal. If the court reviews the transcript and exhibits in this case, there's no factual basis for the finding of unclean hands. As the court knows from review of the case law, there needs to be either an unconscionable result or unconscionable conduct for unclean hands. The result in this case cannot be unconscionable as a matter of law. The result in this case would be a boundary line shift. Now, regardless of the fact that that boundary line shift happens as a matter of these parties once being close, our family members, our friends, is irrelevant. That type of situation happens all the time in these cases. Boundary line disputes happen between family members and friends all the time. And I think the Gabler case supports that, that once the elements of boundary line by practical location are found, the court essentially has to do the boundary line shift and not apply any other equitable defenses to that fact. With respect to the Towley's conduct, there is no evidence of any type of conspiratorial behavior on the part of the Towley's in this case. And the only evidence that the court found in this case to point on the part of any conduct on behalf of the Towley's is the fact that they must have known that the boundary line, the 1955 line, was incorrect based upon a survey that was done in 1993. Now, whether or not they may have known that or not is, in effect, based upon the court's circumstantial inferences drawn from the testimony, I would argue, doesn't matter. because the boundary lines, based upon the 1955 line, was established in place for the required statutory period long before that survey. So any conduct that may have been on the part of Talley's after that 1993 survey is irrelevant because the statutory period for reentry with respect to a boundary line, with respect to boundary line of practical location has passed.
So let me make sure, let me see if I understand this from your argument. So if there was a boundary established along the pipes by acquiescence, it was established between 1955 and 1970, then that was the boundary line in 1970, so anything that happens after 1970 doesn't matter. That's Gabler, right?
That's Gabler, yes.
Okay, so that then, of course, does take us back, if I could, to the what I, and maybe I was just confused when you said that you think that's a bigger issue, because I come back to, then it makes it clear, we got to decide, did the district court err in deciding your clients didn't establish that boundary by practical location? So that, right, can we go back to that issue?
We can't go back to that issue, Your Honor.
Okay. So, first of all, you know, the district court said, look, this, and the district judge, as I understand it, and maybe you were with him, you know, went and looked at this property, and I've looked at the pictures, and the district judge said that the pipe boundary was not certain, visible, and well known. And isn't that a factual finding that, I mean, we entitled to a lot of deference? It's got to be clearly erroneous. And so how is that clearly erroneous? Because let me just say, looking at the pictures, it looked pretty murky.
Well, Your Honor, thank you for the question. Both parties in this case had professional surveys done that demarcated those pipes by two professional surveyors, one by Murray, and I believe two or three by Northwestern Survey Engineering. Those pipes were clearly demarcated, bound, and found to be on a pretty straight path through to one area, kind of following a straight line. And you combine that, not only that evidence, but you combine that with the fact that there was a 1980 permit from Herwick Sr. that he filed in 1980 showing that that 1955 pipeline was the line that he believed where it would be, where he had filed to places to construct his new buildings, and the fact that for the testimony of Mr. Wick Jr. and also the buildings on the ground, that's the line where the parties built structures based upon.
So but I just want to make sure, are these your arguments about why the district court's factual finding was clearly erroneous? I mean, do you agree that is the standard that we should be looking at?
That is the standard. Okay. I agree. Yes. Based upon the fact that the pipelines were clearly demarcated, and the fact that the judge had originally went out there and saw it and agreed that, and the fact that the judge found that originally that the parties had built structures based upon where those pipelines were, the fact that we had the permit, which wasn't really mentioned in the findings, but I mean, the evidence is there. Yes, that is my basis for that being clearly erroneous, Your Honor. And that dovetails into kind of my next point with respect to that, and you brought up the issue with respect to the being clearly acquiescence. Is this case is really similar to the Fisherman case, except you don't have a fence, you have a pipeline where the parties had essentially went there and acquiesced to that line for 15 years by essentially building structures based upon that 1955 pipeline where they clearly marked.
But counsel, wouldn't you agree that a fence is different than a pipes? And I must say, when I first read the district court's opinion, which and then in your briefs, before I started looking at the evidence, I thought, well, maybe they just laid pipes kind of end to end, and it's kind of like a fence. But that wasn't it. They just had pipes sticking periodically in the ground. That strikes me as being pretty different than a fence that was in the Fishman case, as you point out.
Well, it is different, you know, based upon, you know, what type of structures we have. I think in Minnesota cases, there are certain cases where we found boundary lines with less. I mean, we found boundary lines with, you know, in certain cases with agricultural plowing, and in certain cases where people have done and planted things, and certain other markings, to your honor, in other cases. Just because we don't have a fence here, I mean, we have clearly defined boundary placements based upon these markings and these predecessors and title building structures based upon those markings. I think that's clear in the testimony, Your Honor, with that regard, and based upon the from the permit, Your Honor. With respect to the finding that the parties did not acquiesce to this boundary, as I stated previously, the parties went out there. There was testimony from Harold Wood Jr. that they went out and they used survey equipment to mark the pipeline boundaries. They had built structures they could to the pipeline boundaries. They had let these structures exist based upon the location of the pipeline boundaries for years. This whole idea that this was somehow going to be invalidated by a subsequent survey, nobody jumped in to essentially fix that problem. People, the parties and the predecessors in title had essentially let the structures be there for a period of for over 15 years, pursuant to the statute of limitations. There was clear acquiescence in this case,
so,
Your Honor.
What troubled me when I think about whether there's clear acquiescence, because we agree, right, the standard proof is it clear and unequivocal, was Harold Wicks Jr.'s testimony, and where, you know, he's asked, do the parties accept those lines as the true lines? They did not accept them as true, no. It was like a best effort. And then he later says that if some other party somewhere someday wanted to spend the money to survey it, kind of in that sense, that these were working lines. If someone eventually surveys, we're pretty confident we got it right, though. So why isn't that enough to support the district court's finding that there wasn't acquiescence, that these were true lines?
Well, Your Honor, if somebody had got a survey later and it stated, well, the lines are incorrect, and just because, well, if somebody intentionally builds structures based upon working lines that they thought that this was just going to be good enough for a time and then not do anything about it, somebody gets a survey later and says, well, these lines are not correct, even though the parties have essentially acquiesced to the formal line by building structures, just because somebody says, well, they can get a survey later, or we think that this should be subject to a later survey, doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't acquiesce by their action just because they're stating, well, we're just going to make this subject to a later survey. I would argue that the party's actions by letting it reside for a period of time, by building the structures, and even after that Harold Wick Sr. in his testimony stated, well, we knew something was wrong after the 1993 survey and then did nothing about it, and then thinking, well, maybe later somebody might get a survey. Well, that just shows that they still believe that this was the proper line.
Well, I'm looking at finding paragraph number 19 in the district court's post-trial order. This follows on Judge Jessen's question just a moment ago. The district court apparently finds as a fact that all the families understood that the properties would probably be surveyed if an outside party wanted to purchase. According to the testimony of Harold Wick, and I think that's what Judge Justin was looking at, Harold Wick Jr., that is, they also had an unwritten understanding that the families would not contest any boundary lines between the parcels and that transfers of property between the families would not require surveys. However, if an outside party purchased a parcel, a formal survey of the parcel would be necessary. There certainly is evidence in the record different than that. I understand that. You could argue and did argue that the district court should have found the facts differently. But given those facts as found by the district court in its post-trial order, how are we going to say that that's clearly erroneous?
I mean, I think that those facts go to the unclean hands analysis, if I'm not mistaken, in this case.
Well, they may go to unclean hands also, but I think it goes, my interpretation of the recitation in paragraph 19 is that goes to the practical location question. That is that the parties, as the district court found it, did not practically locate the boundary lines. What they said was, we're going to deal with that informally in this level unless and until someone does a survey later. And that in the meantime, we are not going to consider that the practical boundary.
Well, that would limit claims only to outside third parties for boundary line by practical location. So, in other words, are we going to bind the third party, good faith third purchaser? So the good faith third party purchaser would be the only person in this type of case who would ever bring a claim for boundary line by practical location.
No. Not at all. Not at all. I'm saying those are the facts as found. The facts might well have supported a different finding. The testimony and exhibits might have supported different findings, but it seems like the testimony in the record supports these findings, and that's what we're reviewing, not some other case some other day.
That was part of my argument. I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. Well, I guess I would just reiterate my argument that I made prior. I would state that the fact of the matter that there is this agreement, that there is this supposed agreement between these parties, is not enough to override the actual facts on the ground. I think that the action of the acquiescence by the parties of building structures, of going out there on the line by marking the boundary as close as they can to the deeded line is enough to override any type of supposed oral argument that there doesn't seem to be hardly any evidence of. That's all I have. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. I wasn't paying attention. Your time had expired anyway. You got an extra 43 seconds, thanks to Judge Rodenberg. Thank you for your argument. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal time as well. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brian Bingston, and I represent the respondents, the Wicks. The district court, a claim for practical location is an equitable action, and it's subject to certain rules. And one of the rules is that the plaintiffs have to establish their evidence by clear, positive, and unequivocal evidence. And the court must strictly construe the evidence without resort to any influence or presumption in favor of the deceaser, but with every indulgence, every presumption against him. And the acquiescence that is required is not passive consent, but conduct from which assent may be reasonably inferred. This is an adverse possession case, and probably the reason that an adverse possession case wasn't brought was that the parties, with regard to the boundary, were relatives. And as relatives, there would not have been the hostility element allowing a hostility to be established. This also is not a case of a boundary by practical location based upon agreement or by estoppel. It is only upon acquiescence. And the court's findings.
Counsel, that was a question I wanted to talk with you about, because the court does, you know, finds that, one, the pipe boundary wasn't certain, visible, and well-known, but also the second reason for the ultimate decision was there was no agreement that the pipe boundary was the actual boundary. But isn't that kind of mixing apples for oranges? Because as you just said, this is supposed to be about a practical boundary by acquiescence, not by agreement. And for the district court to say, well, there was an agreement, so there's no acquiescence, you know, does that make sense?
I definitely believe that makes sense. For a plaintiff to establish a boundary by practical location, they can base it on acquiescence or that there was an agreement that this is the boundary, two sides together, and say, this is the boundary. Or they can do it by estoppel, which the typical case is where someone knows where the true boundary is, and the deceaser builds upon their property, and the adjoining owner of the deceased property stands silent, lets them do it, knowing of the true boundary, and then waits until after it's all been built to attempt to eject them from the property. What we have here is a case where they're attempting to establish a boundary by acquiescence. And we assert that they can't do that because acquiescence is based upon conduct from which assent may be reasonably be inferred from the conduct. How can a boundary by acquiescence be inferred when the court makes a finding based upon testimony that was contradicted at trial, that rather than there be an agreement that this is a boundary, there was a specific agreement that, hey, this is our best, we're taking a shot at this, we're not surveyors, and this will all be subject to a future survey. We're relatives, we're best friends, we don't want to take anything that's not legally ours. Let's do this line the best we can, and when there's a later survey, we'll abide by it.
Curiously, in the original conclusions of law, the same district court judge said plaintiffs have established by clear, positive, and unequivocal evidence that the plaintiffs, defendants, and their predecessors entitled intended the 1955 pipe monuments to be the boundary between the parties. Then there's a post-trial motion on the unclean hands question, after which the district court makes a diametrically opposed conclusion of law. I'm confused.
Yes, let me address that. Of course, on a motion for amended findings, that authorizes the court to review all the evidence and all of its findings and amend its findings in a manner either favorable or unfavorable to the moving party. And that's what it did in this case. And let me also point out that the court's amended findings are consistent internally, whereas the court's initial findings were it found that they had established a boundary by acquiescence is not consistent with the court's finding that there was unclean hands, because the unclean hands aspect of the court's initial finding was based upon the fact that the court was finding that there was an agreement between the parties that the boundary was not that actual boundary, and then would be subject to a later later survey. And based upon that, the court made quite a number of findings with regard to unclean hands, including that their testimony was not credible, they weren't innocent purchasers, they concealed their knowledge, they took advantage, they acted in bad faith, they were not abiding, they took advantage, unfair gain, did not deal fairly, failed to disclose, and they did not honor the spirit of the agreement. So when the court amended its findings, it had, in one part of the decision, found that there was an agreement. And having reconsidered the evidence that there was an agreement that this would, the effort to find the boundary in 1955 would be subject to a later survey, the court concluded, rightly so, that there could not be a boundary by acquiescence in the face of a specific agreement that this was not the line. Now, truly, some of the parties acted more prudently with regard to the boundary lines than others, and some exercise greater common sense with regard to the placement of property, but they were all relatives or close friends, and there was wasn't that big a concern among the family members there. Now,
so, counsel, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I'm just thinking back to kind of the two reasons that in its final decision that district court made for saying that there, the boundary by practical location was not established. And the first was that the pipe boundary was not certain, visible, and well-known. If we believe, whether or not we would have made that same decision, but if we believe that there is sufficient evidence to support that finding, do we need to reach the issues of whether there was, you know, an agreement or an estimated agreement or, you know, that this whole second basis for the district court's decision?
Well, no, I'm not sure that the court would, because if they fail on that one ground, they fail completely. So if the court sustains that or affirms that there was that the court's decision was right with the fact that the boundary wasn't certain, visible, or well known, then that alone defeats their case. Now, with regard to that, as the court pointed out, this wasn't a stone fence. It wasn't a sod fence. It wasn't a brick fence. There wasn't even a wire fence there. The court points out that the pipes were irregularly spaced and variably sized, and that some pipes were attached to a ham radio tower. The court also noted the uneven topography and the plant growth obstructed a sight line from pipe to pipe. A heavily wooded area, and some of the photographs, the appellant had even circled the pipe in order to show where the pipe was located. And additionally, Kathleen Towley, the appellant here, indicated that when she was a child, that she was over there quite frequently onto the property. As I indicated, there were friends and also relatives involved, and that she only saw one pipe between the north and middle parcels when she was a child. And as the court pointed out, the trial court in this case, all the testimony and viewed the demeanor of witnesses. And but this isn't all the trial court did in this case. The trial judge walked the properties in question and saw these the difficulty of finding these irregularly spaced. And based upon all the evidence, the court determined that the appellants had not proved their case by clear, positive, and unequivocal evidence that the line was certain, visible, and well known. But I think even beyond that, an even stronger issue is with regard to the acquiescence, because the court specifically found that the record demonstrates, and finding essentially in both the first opinion and then the opinion with regard to the motion for amendment findings, that the 1855 pipeline was established as a rough estimate as to where the deeded boundary may be. It reflects an agreement that the 1955 pipeline would be superseded by a later survey. And there's quite a number of things in the record that would support that finding, other than the testimony of the sole surviving witness that participated in that 1955 work. One is the fact that although the Tollies testified that they didn't know where the true boundary was, Mr. Wick's contemporaneous notes indicate that Ms. Tolley admitted that she knew about the 1993 survey and at that time would have known that the lines were not correct. The judge found essentially that the 1955 field work that remained out there was nothing, represented nothing more than historical artifacts.
So if I may, kind of going back to what the district court characterizes, you know, this was established as a rough estimate of where the deeded property would be. But if they established that as a rough estimate, and then built their structures according to those lines, and they did that for 15 years, why isn't that a boundary by practical location? I mean, what's the case that would you can point us to say, now that's not enough?
Well, I'm not sure there is a case on that. They have to establish like clear, positive, and unequivocal evidence that there was acquiescence. And here, there's a specific agreement standing in face of that. If they acted imprudently with regard to locating their property in relation to those lines, there was essentially an agreement between the parties that they and they alone would be responsible to either move that encroachment or to seek some agreement among their friends and relatives with regard to that encroachment. I've got a limited time, and if I could address this one thing here. In Inquist, the court stated that a fence that a builder did not intend as a true boundary line ought not to be relied on by an adjacent landowner who had nothing to do with its construction, location, or use as a division line by acquiescence. Here we have essentially a stranger to this particular boundary between the two Wick families coming in and asserting a boundary by acquiescence and claiming that that was established by 1970 and nothing can be done but with regard to that. That cannot be the law in Minnesota. The reason being is you could have two families living next together, related or not related. They build a fence, live by that fence for 20 years, and then there's a survey done. And they realize that one party is encroaching, and then encroacher says, oh, I'm over my property line, and moves the fence back. Is the law in Minnesota going to be that the next owner, if he sells his property 3 years later, can say, I'm taking that property back. You move that fence because I own that. Because prior to this time, there was a 15-year period where a boundary by practical location was established. Here, after 1993, the court says, you know, the line was abandoned, and essentially that those became nothing more than historical artifacts. He also, you know, mentioned, well, why didn't they do something there as of 1993? Well, they were relatives. There was no rush to get that out. And plus, there was never a survey on their direct line. They didn't know where it was specifically. They just knew that the 1955 survey work was incorrect.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Binkson. I believe your time has expired as well. I'll let you go a little bit over since Mr. Klinger got a little bit of extra time, but the matter is argued. We'll hear now from Mr. Klinger if there's any rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Strikes me as odd that the court found clear and convincing evidence on the boundary line by practical location issue in its initial order, even after review, even after going out to view the pipeline boundaries, pipeline markers, and then reverses itself on the next order. However,
odd as it might be, that you're not suggesting, I don't believe, that the district court is bound by its original findings. After a motion for amended findings is before the court.
I'm not suggesting that, but I was going to lead into something with that, Your Honors. As far as the clear and well I'm sorry. As far as the clear and well known factor of where the boundary pipes were located, I should say that they were located by the surveyors, and the judge did view that on his first order. With respect to the acquiescence issue, I will just conclude by stating that regardless of any supposed agreements, the strongest evidence that we have in this case that should override any of this supposed agreements is, and I think that the parties had marked it as close as they could to get to the deeded lines that were recorded and built structures based upon where they marked the lines in 1955 with the field working pipelines, and they let them sit and basically be there for the statutory period of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The matter is submitted. We appreciate your briefs and your oral argument today. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period.